Hi, I'm Francesca, a registered nutritional therapist, and welcome to the Empowered Perimenopause podcast. This is a space for down-to-earth, honest conversations about what's really going on in your body in your 40s and how to support yourself through it. If you're feeling a bit out of sync, overwhelmed, or just not quite like yourself, you're in the right place. So let's get into today's episode. So this week, I'm bringing back one of the most popular episodes from the archive. With a recent house move again and lots happening behind the scenes, I wanted to revisit a topic this week that has still remained incredibly relevant for so many women navigating perimenopause, and that's stress, cortisol, and why we can feel so exhausted and wired at the same time, and why stress just tends to feel more heightened as we move through this phase. So this was my most listened to episode when it first aired. So if you're new to the podcast, I hope you find it helpful. And if you've heard it before, then maybe you'll pick up something new listening this time with a fresh set of ears. I hope you enjoy it. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Empowered Perimenopause podcast with me, Francesca. So in today's episode, I wanted to talk about this common feelings in our 40s of being just feeling really stressed out more than, you know, in the past, maybe much more anxious, irritable, just feeling like our stress hormones, cortisol, are really high. It can be really common as soon as we kind of move into it, you know, from 40 onwards, to just suddenly start feeling like something's changed. And now I'm just like, I don't have as much resilience to stress anymore. And things that weren't a problem for me before are just getting on top of me. And maybe you're feeling overwhelmed. A lot of anxiety. So if this is you, you are definitely not alone if any of this is sounding familiar already. That's not to say that we don't feel stressed in previous decades, but being in your 40s can often just make feelings of stress and anxiety feel more heightened. You might also be noticing physical symptoms like feeling puffy, maybe in your legs, face and hands, you know, sort of around where you've got your rings or your watch. Maybe around your ankles when you're wearing sports leggings, for example, which is definitely something I've experienced. And you're just thinking, where's this suddenly come from? And you can't sleep anymore. You're feeling like you're tired at night, but you're also really wired and you just can't fall asleep. And when you do fall asleep, you wake up multiple times in the night. So again, if any of this is sounding familiar, you're not alone. It's very common. It doesn't mean that it's okay and we should just say, oh, okay, well, past 40, this is what happens. But that's what this episode is all about. I want to talk you through what's happening as we move into our 40s and then, you know, and understanding what's going on in perimenopause with all of this. And then from there, we can start to make changes. We'll start to, you know, take some of the actions, some of the tips that I'm going to talk about today to help ourselves to feel a lot better. So a lot of women I speak to, they say they know something shifted in their body. They know their response to stress is different. They just don't know why. They just don't know what this is. So some of the most common symptoms of changes in cortisol, so this kind of shift that a lot of us are experiencing, is that we just feel stressed out. We just feel less resilient to life and everything that's happening around us. Less patient, more, as I said, irritable. So we're just more easily irritated or easily angered. We might want to blow up at things that we didn't even notice that much before. And now suddenly all of these different things are making us just feel really annoyed. We might feel burned out. We might feel frustrated a lot. Low energy, and it's not as easy to do all of the things that we want to do anymore. So we might be finding that we used to be able to get XYZ done in a day, and now we're just like just not getting to that anymore. And, you know, we just don't have enough energy in the tank to get all of these things done anymore. We might have been able to be up early and also be up late to run around like mad, just getting everything done, and also have some sort of social existence as well. And now we might just be finding that we're not able to do this stuff anymore. Some of you might be noticing some hair loss that's not quite in a particular area, but more kind of all over. That can be quite common for a high cortisol state. We are also going to, at the end, touch on low cortisol, because that's also a situation. But for now, we're talking about high cortisol. You might find that you've gained weight, particularly around your middle. Sometimes you feel extra puffy all over.
like more so than before. So sometimes just before our period, for example, even in our 20s and 30s, we might have felt a bit puffy around, you know, fingers, wrists and ankles, but it might just be now that we're feeling it all the time. Never mind just before our period, we might just be feeling that our clothes don't fit right, and we just we don't even know if it's genuine weight gain or actual puffiness. And then we might find that we're gaining fat around our waist as opposed to our hips and thighs, or kind of below the waist. So those sorts of areas are kind of less cortisol focused. Like if we're gaining, it's a big sign of high cortisol when we're gaining weight around the midsection, right around the middle, the sort of muffin top, as opposed to on our hips and thighs and below the waist. That's why I say that. So if you're experiencing these things, then it could be a sign that high cortisol is a bigger, so sort of chronic stress is a bigger deal for you than you might have thought. So let's have a look at where cortisol comes from, and is it all bad? So it's definitely not, it's not all bad. It plays a really important role in our health. We need it to survive. It's when it goes out of whack that we run into problems, and cortisol starts to seem like this evil hormone that we all want to get rid of. But in balance, it's really important for our, it's life-saving, it's wonderful. It's part of the normal physiological stress response. So we do need to be able to make it in response to stress. But we also need to be, we also need to have levels of cortisol, for example, to help with our immune function, our circadian rhythm, our sleep, lots of different things in the body. It's anti-inflammatory, for example. But it's just when we get way too much of it, and then what usually follows after a period of time where we do have too much of it chronically, we then, which we'll talk about at the end, we start to fall into a lower cortisol state. So whether it's too high, too low, out of balance, there's a particular pattern it should follow sort of throughout the day, then that's when it becomes a problem and we think it's evil and we just want to get rid of it. But we don't really want to get rid of it. We want to bring it back into balance. So we've got two adrenal glands. These are tiny little glands that sit on top of our kidneys. They release hormones. They release the stress hormones. So they release cortisol when the brain senses a stressor or multiple stresses or some kind of threat, basically. They also release adrenaline, another stress hormone. So these stressors, we have to remember, they can be external. So they can be outside of the body, you know, in the environment, for example, things that are happening to us or around us. Or they can be internal. So they're coming from inside the body, like, say, for example, low blood sugar, points of low blood sugar throughout the day. So if we're fasting for too long, if we're under eating, if we have bacterial infections chronically going on that we don't really know about, for example, in the gut, if we have a virus that we don't know that we're fighting, for example. So these are the sort of internal stressors. So basically, when a stressor, whether it's external or internal, is sensed by the brain, and the brain is constantly scanning, the brain sends signals to your adrenal glands telling them to make some cortisol because there's a stressor here and we need to handle it. So what does cortisol actually do at that point? So in response to that stressor, cortisol helps raise your blood sugar because your brain assumes that you're about to fight or flee the stressor. We unfortunately can't say to our brain, no, it's fine, it's just a bacterial infection, or no, it's fine, it's just I'm just late for work, I'm just stuck in traffic, I'm just in an unhappy relationship, it's fine, I've just had an argument with my partner, it's okay, I'm just worrying about my aging parents. We can't tell our brain we don't need to fight or flee, we're just stressed, we're just unhappy. The brain is, you know, it's just evolved that way, it's programmed that way. It thinks we need, it picks up on the stressor, whatever it is, low blood sugar, stuck in traffic, and it thinks, right, we're about to fight this situation or we're about to run really fast away from it. For example, back in the day when we would have been foraging for food and we come across a tiger, we either have to fight the tiger, but we're probably not going to bother trying, we're going to flee it instead. And we have to run really fast to outrun it and save our life. So it's the same thing in our modern day life, but we can't, as I said, tell the brain it's not that case, it's not the case anymore. So, you know, to be able to fight or flee, your body physically needs energy, and so does your brain for the cognition part of fighting or fleeing. hence the raising of blood sugar, which is glucose, instantly so that we can run fast right now or fight really hard right now. So this glucose, this sugar, is for your brain and your skeletal muscles, basically, so that you have the brain energy to think and the physical energy to do. The big problem today, as I said, is that we just don't need to fight or flee from these modern day stressors. So as I mentioned, we've got things like receiving a shitty email or text from a colleague or a friend or a loved one, family member, or a letter from the bank reminding you of a debt or an upcoming payment you don't have the money for, disagreements with a partner or another loved one, family member, sitting in traffic when you're late, a sick child, an aging parent who you're worried about, a meeting at work you're dreading, being unwell, a manager you don't get on with, a colleague you don't get on with, a job you hate, a draining friend who's just always very, very negative, and it's all you ever hear and see from that person, and it's, you know, whether you realize it or not, it is upsetting you or just draining you, making you feel annoyed. So we don't need all of this cortisol or glucose for these things that we get, you know, but we get it anyway, because as I said, that's just how the brain is programmed. So cortisol gets pumped out regardless. You know, for us, those of us with young children, not me, but you know, plenty of women in their 40s with small children, and or any age in between that and up to, you know, late teens, early 20s, and they all come with their own different types of stresses, don't they, all the different ages. But let's say you're running ragged in the morning just trying to get all the kids ready and out the door if they're smaller, and then you're also trying to get yourself ready and get yourself to work on time. Again, all of this cortisol is just getting pumped out, even though you don't need to fight or flee those situations. Even exercising beyond your current capacity is a stressor. So for example, let's say you have this kind of typical modern day stressors around us that we just mentioned, and then you're doing lots of spin classes each week, so-called HIIT classes. I've touched on this in previous episodes, but these sort of intense 45 minute or 60 minute like HIIT circuit classes or F45 types of things, again, tons of cortisol being pumped out in these classes, and all of this leads to blood sugar issues and all kinds of things that we're going to talk about later. But as I mentioned at the beginning as well, cortisol is anti-inflammatory. So for example, if we hurt ourselves, we cut ourselves, if we need to fight the flu or other viruses, cortisol helps your immune system. And when the immune system has done its fighting, cortisol should return to normal. Just like, you know, if we're chronically making more and more cortisol day after day because the stresses just keep coming, this is where we're going to have all of this cortisol flooding the system. But because we're not fighting or fleeing, we're not actually getting rid of it and things returning to normal. And then it can lead, this is where this situation of chronically high levels of cortisol, chronic stress, basically, can lead to chronic disease, because it starts to create blood sugar issues, blood pressure issues, heart issues, increased visceral fat, which is the fat that sits around your organs. And it's what's known as metabolically active, meaning it's dangerous to health in high amounts. And it can also be a cause of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, which is becoming more and more common. And we also run into issues with our immune system as well. So now when we get viruses or we cut ourselves or hurt ourselves, we don't actually have as much anti-inflammatory impact from cortisol that we should have, because it's now just so sort of out of whack. You might also start to see, as I said already, hair loss, but also issues with your skin, your nails. So a lot of, you know, these kind of going off track here, but some supplements with kind of skin, hair and nail supplements, right? So they've got good nutrients in them to support skin, hair and nails. But if we are chronically stressed, they're only going to take us so far. We need to work on that stress. We need to work on the cortisol issue, and then skin, hair and nails will probably improve, if chronic stress is the issue. So yeah, the reason you might start to see skin, hair and nails issues is because when you have a lot of stress, the brain decides that now isn't the right time to be making other hormones and other sort of enzymes that kind of support our connective tissue and support our health, because right now we just need to survive. So The most important thing is to just keep making lots of stress hormones and not really focus on making anything else. So, for example, progesterone is one of those hormones that starts to be we start to not make enough of or any of, because progesterone is made only as a result of having ovulated. So go back to episodes two and three, I think, where I've talked about this in more detail, and I'll talk about it a lot more in the future. But because we only make progesterone as a result of ovulating, in times of chronic stress, the brain doesn't signal to our ovaries to tell them to ovulate, and therefore we don't make progesterone. So obviously this is something that should be happening monthly. So it could be that some months the brain is like extra stress, sensing extra stress, so it doesn't signal down and we don't ovulate and we don't make progesterone. And it might be that some months we do manage to have that process of ovulation happen, but it might not happen very well because there's still a level of stress there that's preventing a really optimal amount of progesterone being made from the ovulation process. The same with testosterone and estrogen. So the adrenal glands make a hormone called DHEA, which is actually what then goes on to be converted into testosterone. So if the adrenal glands are too overwhelmed with stress hormone production, they can't do much else. And then we've got the fact that the ovaries stop getting the right signals at the right time from the brain, because if there's chronic stress there, the brain just will not signal down to the ovaries at the right times anymore. And then estrogen production is also impacted. Also thyroid hormones. So stress is a big reason why thyroid hormone production slows down. We don't make that T4. And again, it's impacting proper brain to thyroid communication. So stress is huge. It has a huge, huge impact. And we really do need to be taking it more seriously 40 plus. It just means that stress management becomes much more important now than ever before. So what should really be happening is that our stresses should be few and far between and only acute, not chronic. So for example, having a minor car accident, let's say someone goes into the back of you, it doesn't happen often, hopefully never, but you know, for some, let's say it might happen once in your life, but it's a short-lived stressor. In this situation, your stress hormones are produced, all of the body processes are switched on that we just mentioned. So your blood pressure goes up, your blood sugar goes up, your brain and skeletal muscles get the energy that they need pumped out in the moment just to help you deal with that stressor. But then normal physiology should return once that stressor passes, because it will pass. You know, somebody going into the back of you, it will only happen that once and then it passes. But chronic everyday stress is just always there, right? And if we don't address our sort of daily routines, if they are problematic, because we're just trying to do too much, we've got too much going on, we're juggling all these things, we're stuck in traffic, we're then rushing to a spin class at 7 o'clock after we've done everything, you know, it's just constant, isn't it? It's just this constant chronic stress. And the bigger issue that we run into as we move into perimenopause, so 40 plus, is that as progesterone levels are naturally declining now and estrogen levels are fluctuating on an erratic roller coaster, that situation puts cortisol levels naturally rise. So take stress out of the picture, and let's say you've got a woman in her 40s who lives on an island, a beautiful island, and she just doesn't have any stress. She is still going to be in a more naturally higher cortisol state because of the change in progesterone and estrogen that she's going through in perimenopause. But what's happening for women like us who don't live on desert islands, not desert islands, but fun islands where we're just really happy and we don't have any stress, we've got that added situation where the chronic stress that we do have just makes everything worse, because we're also physiologically naturally in a higher cortisol state as well. So we, as I said, we just need to make stress management much more of a focus. It should be a priority, self-care and stress management. So essentially stress management is about taking care of your nervous system. So when we talk about the nervous system, I'm referring to this complex network of nerves and cells that run throughout the body that basically carries messages to and from the brain. So it all starts in the brain. It's through the activation of the nervous system that we respond to threat or stress, any kind of stressors. This is a particular branch of the nervous system known as the autonomic nervous system, or the ANS. You don't need to remember that. But that's, you know, when people talk about supporting your nervous system, they're basically just talking about supporting your stress response system, basically, in the body. And earlier when I said that the brain is continuously scanning for threats and responding to threats, it's the nervous system specifically. And it all starts in the brain, and then it's sending signals down to sort of the rest of the body and to the adrenal glands, for example. So let's look at ways that we can start to support the nervous system and the stress response. So basically, your nervous system needs to know that you're safe. It needs to be, it's always thinking, are you safe? Do you feel safe? Do you feel happy? Is there joy? Do you feel supported? Are you surrounded by loved ones? Is there some kind of community here? Are you happy in your work? Are you happy in your relationship? Are you happy in your home? Is it safe there? Is there a source of sadness or frustration in your life every day? So evaluating your relationships, your work, your mindset, your thoughts, your environment, your lifestyle habits, you know, this might be where some people really need to start. So thinking about what's going on that might be disrupting your ability to feel content or feel happy or feel safe. You know, it's not that we need to be running around emphatically like smiling all day because we're just so excited and happy. Like, obviously we don't need to, it's not that extreme. It's just feeling content. So it's about thinking about what might be disrupting our ability to feel safe, to feel content. If we're unhappy, for example, in a job or a relationship, and this is all we're ever thinking about, then that's chronic stress. If we have just a negative mindset, if we're constantly seeing the bad in things, if we're constantly seeing what we don't have, if we're constantly seeing the lack, what we haven't got yet, what we haven't done yet, what we haven't achieved yet, if we're just constantly seeing it like, you know, this thing happened today and it's all because it's me, it's just typical me that would happen to me, you know, I missed a parking space or whatever, however trivial or big it might be. If we're just constantly seeing it as a sort of negative thing, then again, that is just a source of chronic stress. You might have a chronic illness. So, you know, now we're going to another sort of extreme. So you might have a chronic illness that you're trying to live with and you're trying to manage it every day. And that's creating a lot of stress, a lot of sadness in your life, a lot of frustration, you know, rightly so. But again, these are just examples of sources of stress. So this is where we need to be able to cultivate some joy, some play, some sense of support and community in our days, time for things we love doing, places we like to be, because a lot of the stresses we may not be able to eliminate, you know, if we are dealing with a chronic illness every day, if we just do have XYZ going on every day and we can't sort of change it, if we are, let's say, supporting aging parents as well as doing a full-time job and having our own children to support, and then we also have to do this at the end of the day or at the weekends, we may not be able to take these things away because they are our responsibilities and we want to do them even though they're stressful, but we just want to cultivate some things, like incorporate some things into our days and weeks that basically help to counteract, you know, so it's not all stress. It doesn't even have to be elaborate things. So what can you incorporate into your daily life that allows even a small sprinkling of happiness every day, preferably multiple times? But again, it can be so small. It can be like the smell of fresh coffee, if that's what you like. And, you know, if you love the smell of fresh coffee, is there a way you can bring that into your home so you can invest in something that allows you to make fresh coffee at home and you can experience that smell and make a ritual out of it, even if it's just for 3 minutes, a moment outside listening to the birds while you drink it? Is it that you need to be outside more? How can you get outside more? Again, even if it's just for a few minutes at a time, chats with neighbors, laughter, watching your favorite comedians. This is something that I keep saying I must do, is like gather a list on Netflix of my favorite stand-up comedians and just have this sort of playlist that I'll just go to every so often, even if it's just for 5 minutes in a lunch break if I'm working from home, or get it on a, you know, Spotify, listening to music that you love, just snippets. How can you bring snippets of joy and happiness into your day? A short meditation on the sofa between work calls, if you're somebody who can work from home, or if you're, you know, if you can't do things like that, a moment outside, just looking around, people watching, whatever it might be, just how can you bring these little snippets of joy into your days? So all of these sorts of things will just bring about this positive emotion that tells your brain and your nervous system that you're safe. If the brain senses positive emotions, it thinks you're safe. So remember, the brain is always thinking threat or safety, threat or safety. Which one is this? And it's trying to categorize all of these things. So anything negative is threat. This person needs to fight or flee. Anything positive is safe. This person doesn't need to fight or flee. They can just chill. We're in rest and digest mode. We're in just this calm mode of our nervous system. So tiny little changes and adjustments over time, and then big adjustments where needed and where possible, if there are things that can be taken away or delegated or changed. But just these tiny little micro adjustments over time all add up to something really great for your nervous system and your overall health. So those are the kind of little things we might be able to consider. But other things we also need to consider are things like our sleep. I've touched on exercise, but I'll talk about that a little bit more. Hydration. Do we need to support with helpful supplements, which can't outrun any of the other sort of stuff that I've just talked about, but they can support. So we need to consider our sleep. This is a big one for our nervous system. So poor sleep is basically another stressor. If the body senses sleep deprivation, it thinks threat, fight or flight. Again, like I said, low blood sugar is an issue. So if we're under eating, if we're over fasting, if we're fasting for too long. So if we're somebody, I talked about intermittent fasting in the previous episode, I think episode 7, and I was talking about fast this 16-8. So the idea that you fast for 16 hours between overnight, between finishing dinner and starting your breakfast the next day, and you eat in an 8-hour window. That has been shown to be really great for health. A lot of that research has been done on men, not much of it has been done on women yet. But what we really need to consider is that female physiology is quite different. So we have this extra sensitivity when it comes to our adrenal glands and the stress response and progesterone, estrogen changing the sort of hormone stress response terrain, basically, as we move into our 40s. So possibly 16 hours of fasting is a little bit too much for a lot of women. I've definitely tried it, and it's just a little bit too far for me. My sweet spot is 14 hours. That's always I always come back to that as my sweet spot if I ever try to go outside of that. So I eat in a 10-hour window and I fast for 14 hours. Some days I fast for 13. Some days it has to be 12. It really depends on what's going on that day. But just to say, to not go off on a tangent, because I talked about this in the previous episode, but fasting for too long, where blood sugar is just dropping lower and lower and lower, is a stressor. Adrenal glands kick in, brain senses low blood sugar as a threat. So we want to get in there before that point comes. That's why I say for me, it's 14 hours, not 16. Again, if we're somebody who is just restricting calories, we're just not eating enough, we're under eating, the brain will sense that as a threat. And again, fight or flight. This person needs to fight or flee. They haven't got enough food. It's survival mode. Same poor sleep. So if we are constantly just, you know, getting 5 hours sleep, in most sleep studies, the research is calling sleep deprivation, basically anything under sort of 6 hours. Some studies even say under 7, but definitely under 6. So if you're someone who's just always getting 6 hours or 5.5, you know, you may need to look at that, because the brain could be sensing this as a stressor. So thinking about things like what you're doing in the evenings in the lead up to bedtime, this is huge. I'll do a whole separate episode on sleep. But just for today's session, I'm going to just briefly touch on this. So, you know, if we're scrolling at night before bed, Netflix all evening, jumping on the computer to buy this and buy that, or catching up on our emails, responding to WhatsApp messages, then having a big old scroll before we go to bed, this just really isn't good. It's what a lot of us do, and we have the ability to do it. It's so easy to do it. You've got all these devices, and, you know, we also have the ability now to get on with certain things in our day and say, oh, I'll just check my emails later instead when I'm getting ready for bed, or sitting on the sofa before bed, or when I'm lying in bed, I'll just check all my WhatsApp messages and respond to everybody. And you've got WhatsApp groups, and you've got family meetups groups being, you know, all these arrangements going on, and you've got that friend who's sending you negative stuff that you could just listen to, like, you know, read in the morning, but you just want to look at it now. Nighttime is just not the time for these things. And, you know, I really do understand that some of us just don't have the time in the other parts of the day, as we just all have different levels of responsibilities and things to juggle. I really do get that. But you can make a change to the late night messaging, and definitely to the scrolling. You can do it. What do we actually get out of scrolling? No one gets anything at all. We just get a bit more cortisol, because certain things will trigger a certain emotion, usually negative, whether it's comparison or even if it's excitement. It's too late for that before bed, and it just leads to a bad night's sleep. It's interfering with your sleep, and your sleep would be so much more restorative if you got off your phone and other devices at least an hour before heading to bed. So if you're somebody who gets into bed at 11 o'clock most nights, from at least 10 o'clock, preferably 9:30, 9 o'clock, put the devices down, put them on flight mode, put them on, if you have to use the settings on your phone where you can turn certain apps off after a certain time, you know, just do that. I'm probably quite extreme, but my WhatsApp and social media apps go off at 7:45 on weekdays, and like a little bit later on the weekend. And there's certain people in my life who I need them to know how to contact me in an emergency. And they just know not to go via WhatsApp or social media, because they're not going to get me after a certain time. So my sister, for example, she knows if there's something important after 7:45, I get a text from her and it might say, please go in and check your WhatsApp. You have to, you know, she will only do it if it's an emergency. So something like that to just put in place. So winding down at night is basically so much more important now more than ever. So when our physiology is more susceptible to these high stress hormones, it's so important that we give ourselves this wind down time. So you might be thinking, well, I never used to need to do this. But this is what I'm saying. You need to do it now, because you didn't really need to focus on this as much in your 30s, even mid to late 30s, because you weren't as susceptible to these high stress hormones. Your physiology was more robust back then. Now that we're in perimenopause and that hormonal terrain changes, we're just more sensitive. So we really do have to give ourselves this wind down time. So dim the lights all around the home from early evening, if possible. The later it gets, the more important this is. Even when you need to go to the bathroom, can you keep it dim in there too? I've got a little dimmer light in there, so when you walk in, it's like a sensor. I do have to charge it. I charge it up maybe once a week. And it's just enough light for me to do what I need to do in the bathroom, to see the toothpaste, to see all the stuff I use to cleanse my face and so on. So just thinking about all these little things that you can do to just support a better wind down at night. And then exercise. So are you pushing yourself too much when it comes to exercise? Or maybe you're not doing anything and you're just too sedentary. Either way is actually a stressor. But what's most common, especially women as they move into their 40s, when they're maybe finding that they're gaining extra belly fat, they don't know why, they embark on more exercising. So that's the most common thing that I see, is women overdoing things like, again, multiple spin classes a week, or HIIT or some other sort of crazy batter yourself class, two gym classes back to back to make up for skipping a day in the week, multiple long runs each week, just lots of time on the cardio machines at the gym. These can all be, like I mentioned it in the last episode, they can have their place, but they work better in previous decades. They don't work as well 40 plus. They can all be what's known as too catabolic. So catabolic meaning that it raises cortisol, and that raise in cortisol can lead to a breaking down of our muscle tissue and a storing of fat around the middle. So if you listen to the episode on why we gain weight 40 plus, which is episode 5, you'll remember that I talked about this in there. So basically this type of just too much high intensity, like kind of cardio classes, circuit classes, spin classes, these kind of things, done too much is just another stress on your physiology. So if you're someone just loves the act of going to the gym, say 5 times a week, which is definitely me, I like to go But I balance it out in terms of what I actually do. So can you, for example, replace one of those if you're someone who's going to 4 or 5 spin classes, as an example, or you're just focusing on lots of cardio? Can you replace one of those sessions with a gentle yoga class? Can you replace another session with some proper strength training, heavy weightlifting without the sort of conditioning part? Can you maybe replace another session with a walk in nature? So those, you know, making these sort of adjustments can really take you a long way in terms of reducing or rebalancing, I should say, our stress response system for the better. Also doing this kind of stuff at night. So there's a lot of women that can only find time to get to the gym in the evenings when everything's done. But it's just not helpful, because that's when we need cortisol to be coming down, not hiking up. So a gentle walk after dinner, maybe, yeah, absolutely fine. But anything high intensity, you're just increasing cortisol when it really needs to be coming down, leaving you going to bed tired but really wired and not having a good night's sleep. On the flip side of that, if you're quite sedentary, then starting with getting out walking every day or every other day to begin with and build up, say, I don't know, 5,000, 7,000 steps or anywhere from 20 to 60 minutes, using a route that takes you through some nature ideally as well. Listen to a podcast as you walk, like use it as a time to multitask. Is there something that you needed to listen to? Maybe someone's left you a voice note, you need to listen to it, and this is the perfect time. Maybe you're learning something online, you can just listen to it. But when you get to the nature part, take your earbuds out and be present. So listen to the sounds, soak in the sights that you see, because research shows that seeing nature sends and hearing nature sends calming, happy signals to the brain. So I think the research was showing that even just 2 hours a week in total spread across your 7 days in nature, mindfully, has been shown to benefit, you know, mood, cognition, and even energy levels, because of the effect it has on the brain and calming our stress hormones. And then are you hydrated enough? Do you drink enough water? So being properly hydrated supports your adrenal glands, but specifically it's potassium. So potassium is one of the electrolytes. You've got magnesium, potassium, sodium. Potassium is one of them, but it's one of the most important electrolytes that a lot of women are low on. And this, we need potassium to support our adrenal glands. So yes, whilst we need to drink a certain amount of water every day, we also need to be getting enough potassium. So if you're someone, for example, who's already using electrolytes, then you want to make sure that they do actually contain potassium, around 200 milligrams of potassium. But a lot of these cheaper or more sort of commercial based electrolytes, they just don't even have potassium. If you read the label, they've got a little bit of sodium, a little bit of magnesium, and loads of sugar, and there's no potassium. So yeah, we need potassium in an electrolyte blend. So my favorite brands for electrolyte, unfortunately, I've only found two. There's one called Element, which is LMNT, and then there's one called Revive. Those two are my favorite brands. They're the only ones I can find with the proper sort of composition of ratios of potassium, sodium, and magnesium. So you can also make up your own electrolytes. You can buy magnesium malate powder. Somewhere like iHerb would sell this kind of thing. You can buy potassium powder, and then you can also have some fine pink Himalayan sea salt for your sodium. And the composition, if you can even go to their websites, the Element website or the Revive website, and see what their composition breakdown is of these three, and basically copy that. So this is what I do. It tastes horrible, because there's just nothing to take the edge off. It's horrid. So what I actually do to save money is I buy a pack of 30 sachets of the Element or Revive electrolyte, and then I make up my own. I make up the equivalent of 30 servings of my own, and then I mix all of it together, and I get 60 servings for the price of 30. So I understand that might be a lot of work for some people, and you might just pay. But that's just my little tip there. But yeah, obviously making sure you're properly hydrated with water. But do you have enough potassium in your life as well to support your adrenal glands? And then we've got supportive supplements as well. So nothing trumps, you know, your daily lifestyle habits and actually managing stress, getting good sleep, looking at your exercise, making sure you're not fasting too long or under eating. You've got a blood sugar balancing diet, which is a whole separate episode. So I haven't really gone into that. I'm just touching on that today. But the supportive supplements can just be that cherry on top. They're not instead of. So one thing that's really important and like something I would never live without is magnesium glycinate. So the particular form known as glycinate has glycine in it, which is a calming amino acid. Plus, you might have heard of magnesium citrate, which is okay, but it can cause loose stools. So we don't really want that. So there's no kind of gut issues from magnesium glycinate. But the glycine with that paired with that calming amino acid, it just gives us that additional layer of calm. It doesn't mean that it makes us feel really calm, like we're sitting there like, whoa, this is tripping out or anything, or we're that you shouldn't drive or anything. It's just a calming impact on the nervous system. So taken before bed, it just helps to support a calm and a good sleep, but it doesn't make us drowsy. That was the word I was looking for. So with magnesium glycinate, we want a minimum, at least sort of 400 milligrams a day. So anywhere between, I'd say 400 and 600. You will see magnesium in multivitamins or even in the electrolytes, because I mentioned it as part of electrolyte composition. But the amount of magnesium in these products is just not enough. It's like some really good quality multivitamins now, they don't even include magnesium because they know that, you know, if they know their stuff, they know that we need about 400 milligrams of magnesium for it to actually do anything. So they don't even bother putting it in there. They just know that you'll buy a separate one. So it's just not enough of what's in these multivitamins. So you do need to take it as a separate product. And it's not an expensive nutrient to take. So just make sure you're looking for that magnesium glycinate form. Taken before bed or in the lead up to bedtime, as I said, it can just help calm the nervous system and support a better night's sleep. And that, if we're getting better night's sleeps, we're going to have less cortisol and less stress, you know, less fight or flight. So I sometimes also recommend taking 100 milligrams of magnesium glycinate in the morning as well, just to help calm the nervous system for the day ahead. And as I said, it doesn't make us drowsy. But this is something I've started to do recently, and I do think it's helping. I feel like I'm just having a calmer day. So I take 600 milligrams in total, 200 in the morning and then 400 in the evening. Vitamin C is another one that's really helpful for our adrenal health. So for the adrenal glands to work. We can't actually make that much vitamin C ourselves in the body. And of course, there's lots of foods that we can get vitamin C from, like colourful berries and citrus fruits and all the different colours of vegetables and leafy greens and, you know, red peppers and tomatoes. But it might just not be in the therapeutic amounts that can support the adrenal glands if we are chronically stressed and in, you know, perimenopausal. So vitamin C is a really powerful antioxidant. And it's heavily concentrated in our adrenal glands. And basically, it plays a role in the production of adrenaline and cortisol that, you know, while the adrenals are making them. So the more stress we have, the more we're using, the more vitamin C we're burning through to make these hormones. And that just leaves us depleted of this really important antioxidant and immune support nutrient. So we can support this by putting it back and supplementing with around 1,000 to 2,000 milligrams of vitamin C every day. You could sort of take it morning and night, for example, 1,000, 1,000. I like it in the form of ascorbic acid and preferably the powder, because it's better tolerated and better absorbed that way. And you can put it into your morning rehydration water when you wake up in the morning, and then in your water that you're using at night to take your magnesium glycinate capsules. Then we have helpful herbs. So you might have already heard of something known as adaptogenic herbs. Something, for example, a really popular one is ashwagandha. So we'll get into that. But as I said already, lifestyle habits are the absolute most important pieces here. So you can take all the helpful nutrients and herbs in the world, but if your lifestyle habits are going against your body's calm physiology, your brain is just constantly getting threat, threat, threat. This is threat. She's the threatful situation, then you're constantly just doing things that are spiking cortisol pretty much all the time. If you don't have a good wind down routine in the evening, you're not sleeping well, spiking cortisol again, you're exercising at night, you're exercising too much through the week, generally doing the wrong types of things, you're unhappy in everything you do, you've got no sense of joy, you just don't have any habits in place that support rebalancing cortisol, sending calm signals to the brain, then taking all of these herbs and supplements, you're just going to be, the saying I like is milking a carrot. You're just not going to get what you want out of it. You'll basically be keeping the bucket from overflowing, but you're never actually managing to empty the bucket. So, which is really just getting your physiology back into balance. So that being said, though, there are helpful herbs to add in alongside your magnesium and your vitamin C and your healthier habits that can really support you and move the needle just so much more. So one called, and this is actually a new one that I've actually only just started using in my practice with clients, it's called Relora. It's a blend of magnolia bark and another plant known as, I can never say this word, phelodendron. There we go, P-H-E-L-L. Phelodendron. So these two plants make up this product, Relora, which is a trademarked name. They have calming, stress relieving properties, basically. So these two combined, Relora, can help to deactivate cortisol. So it's really helpful when you have a lot of cortisol floating around. It's thought that it can reduce the chronic overproduction of cortisol, especially in people who are experiencing prolonged chronic stress, which is quite a lot of people in this day and age. And studies have basically shown that it helps to moderate that sort of stress response from the adrenal glands, the brain and the adrenal glands, just leading to more balanced cortisol rather than the elevated and dysregulated levels. So we do need cortisol, as I said, we just don't want it to be dysregulated. So Relora can help with that. Then we've got L-theanine, which is a lovely brain calming amino acid. So we can take this in capsule form. We also get L-theanine in naturally in good quality loose leaf green tea. So that's why green tea, even though it contains a little bit of caffeine, doesn't have the same jittery impact that we would get from like coffee, which is a more concentrated form of caffeine, and it doesn't come with the calming L-theanine. So I like taking L-theanine capsules in the middle of the day, as I sometimes feel a bit wired in the afternoon after like a really brain heavy morning of intense work. If I'm delivering like webinars that morning or seeing lots of clients, I can feel really wired in the afternoon, and the calming effect of L-theanine just helps me get sort of through the rest of the day feeling calmer rather than just getting myself more and more wired. And then come the evening, I'm like, whoa, so wrecked, but I can't sleep. Or if you know you've got a stressful event or stressful situation coming up, you could take it about half an hour before to help calm your brain, keep your brain nice and calm. So it's worth giving it a try. Then we've got something called phosphatidylserine. So we actually have phosphatidylserine in our cell membrane. So cell membranes are the outer layer of all of the cells. We've got cells in our body and brain all over. And this compound actually lives in there. It's like a kind of fatty compound. So we need a lot of this in order to keep those cell outer layers healthy. But also this compound is another one that can calm the stress response because it sends calming signals to the brain, which means the brain doesn't tell the adrenal glands to make so much cortisol. So do remember, as I said, lifestyle habits can also do this every day as well. So being in nature, but actually being there mindfully, taking in the sights and the sounds, deep breathing practices, gratitude journaling, or simply just like making a mental note of every day of things that you're grateful for, what's good in your life, or writing it in your phone, good sleep, genuine love and connection, doing things that bring you joy, expressing creativity. All of these things also send calming signals to the brain. So these supplements, as I said, they're helpful, but we can also achieve a lot of this through our habits that we're talking about. So we do need to be doing those things, but the supplements are just that sort of cherry on top if we just need that extra support. So what we've talked about here is high cortisol, which is the assumption that most people make when they have like various symptoms of typical high cortisol, like, we're just very stressed in life. It's quite normal that we just assume we've got high cortisol. So lots of anxiety, this kind of heightened sense of irritability and annoyance and lack of patience, we do assume it's high cortisol. And, you know, it likely is, because those are typical symptoms of high cortisol. But what's also important to consider is that after a period of time of being in a high cortisol state, so after we've been in chronically high cortisol for a while, we then tend to move into a chronically low cortisol state. So moving to a chronically low cortisol state after being in a chronically high cortisol state is something we call HPA axis dysregulation. So H stands for the hypothalamus, which is the control center of the brain. P stands for the pituitary gland in the brain, which is a bit further down. And the A stands for the adrenal glands. So axis just basically means their communication, their connection with each other. So HPA axis is basically the H and the P is in the brain, the adrenal gland, the A is the adrenal glands. Axis means communication. So brain to adrenal gland communication dysregulation is basically what ends up happening after a prolonged period of time with having high stress hormones, high cortisol chronically. We then get this dysregulation in brain to adrenal communication. So in the past, this was referred to as adrenal fatigue, but we now know that the adrenal glands, they don't actually fatigue. They don't literally just get really tired and stop making stress hormones. It's more that the brain to adrenal gland communication breaks down, becomes dysregulated, and we no longer get stress hormones being made by the adrenal glands in times of stress. And we are left in a chronically low cortisol state. So let's look at this, some of the typical symptoms of both states. So symptoms from chronically high cortisol, sleep disruption or insomnia. Your sleep's just no longer restorative. You're tired but wired at night. Poor memory. Can't remember things, can't get words out. You can't focus. You've got that sort of brain fog. Can't remember what I was doing. Can't remember what I was going to do. Can't remember who I was talking to. Who was I just about to send a message to? That sort of brain fog. Trouble focusing. Cannot focus for longer than a certain amount of time. You just don't get things done anymore. Low energy, fatigue, especially in the afternoon or early evening. Belly fat. So increased belly fat, that kind of increased ever-growing muffin top. Increased visceral fat, which you won't necessarily know unless you have a DEXA scan or have a really good set of body composition scales that tell you that. Raised blood pressure, so high blood pressure, now you're suddenly being told you need high blood pressure meds. Always feeling like you're on high alert, you know, just waiting and someone comes into the kitchen as an example and starts talking really loud. And like, this happens to me all the time when I'm in the kitchen and my partner just walks in and people are like, oh, I just start talking really loud. And I'm like, ah, oh, and I just scream. He's like, what is wrong with you? I live here. And I'm like, I know, but you just terrified me, like this sort of high alert, just increased feelings of anxiety, chronic inflammation in the body, which might cause things like joint pain, muscle aches and pains, headaches, brain fog, fatigue, trouble losing body fat, suppressed or low immunity. So you might always be getting colds. You can't fight viruses off as quickly as the next person. Hormonal imbalances, sex hormones, thyroid hormone. But when we're perimenopausal, we are in a hormonal imbalance state. Digestive issues, because, you know, maybe bloating after a meal, flatulence. Just not breaking down our meals properly, basically. And then symptoms that arise from chronically low cortisol. So slightly different in that we now start to feel fatigued, particularly on waking up and pretty much all day, maybe ups and downs, but pretty much all day. Low mood, depression, low motivation, anxiety. So we do get the anxiety, but it's maybe not this like sort of high alert, heightened that we might have felt with high cortisol. But now we've got lower resilience. Maybe we're more teary. We just can't deal with things anymore. We find it really difficult. We've got such a low tolerance now for anything. We're very easily overwhelmed. Again, that can happen with high cortisol. So, but yeah, just trying to give you that picture here. Chronic inflammation, again, with both high and low cortisol. So the muscle and joint aches and pains, the headaches, the brain fog. Low blood pressure now. So now Instead of it being high, it's low. So we might feel faint or dizzy, particularly from when we're getting up from lying down or sitting down. It might be that we get up in, out of bed in the morning and just feel a bit lightheaded, a bit dizzy again when we stand up. So hopefully that helps to just sort of explain the differences between the two, but also you can see there's a lot of overlap. So now if we are somebody who has moved into the chronically low cortisol state, and we have this HPA axis, this brain to adrenal gland dysregulation, then we may not want to be taking herbs that specifically support the reduction in cortisol, like that phosphatidylserine that I just mentioned and Relora. You know, we shouldn't really be taking these if we're actually in a low cortisol state, because we don't want it to lower it. But you would want to be taking herbs that adapt to either scenario. So these are known as adaptogenic herbs. And the most popular one, as I mentioned, is ashwagandha. Then there's rhodiola, eleuthero, holy basil, Panax ginseng, and also pantothene, which is actually a form of vitamin B5. It's been shown to be an adaptogen. So it's not herb, but it's an adaptogen. So any of those, preferably as part of a blend, can be really helpful to adapt to either scenario, because you won't necessarily know for sure. Yes, you can go by symptoms, but you won't necessarily know for sure which one you're dealing with. So the adaptogenic herbal blend can be more helpful, you know, to be safer. And then we've got licorice. So licorice contains a compound called glycerin. It's not glycerin, it's spelled, so glycerin. That's not what I'm talking about. This is spelled completely differently. Licorice, so you can just look up the active ingredient in licorice. And that can influence cortisol levels by affecting the way it's basically broken down in the body. So it can basically prevent, it can help to increase cortisol levels. So again, if we're somebody who has genuinely high levels of cortisol all the time, we don't want to be taking licorice, because licorice can increase it. So licorice, this active compound in it, it increases the half-life of cortisol, which basically means that it allows cortisol to remain active in the bloodstream for longer. This glycerin compound in licorice also inhibits a particular enzyme, got a very long name, known as 11-beta hydroxysteroid dehydrogenase type 2. You don't need to remember that, but just know that licorice can inhibit that enzyme, and that enzyme converts active cortisol into its inactive form, which is known as cortisone. So by inhibiting this enzyme, it means there's more active cortisol in circulation. So again, you wouldn't want to take licorice if you have high cortisol. You only want to take it if you have low cortisol. So sometimes I get like friends or family members that send me a screenshot of a supplement. They're like, oh, I'm going to buy this. And I see it's got licorice. And I'm like, well, unless we know you have low cortisol, you shouldn't be taking that. We don't know if it's low. What if it's high and you're taking licorice and it's making it higher? So as I said, you could, of course, go by symptoms, but the most effective way to actually know for sure is to do what's called a 4-point saliva test for cortisol. So this is a test where you're basically measuring your cortisol levels at 4 different times throughout the day, usually in the morning around waking, and then again at midday, again mid-afternoon, and again just before bed in the evening. And that shows us your daily pattern of cortisol, which is also really important, the actual pattern, what level it's at, those 4 points I just mentioned, because that gives us insight into your circadian rhythm health. Circadian rhythm being the natural biorhythm body clock in our body. And I'm going to do a whole separate episode on this. But that's also really important for good health, is having a healthy circadian rhythm in all it, basically cortisol being at the right levels at all of those 4 different points throughout the day. And it's also known as a diurnal pattern, a daily pattern, meaning that it should be high in the morning to help you wake up. And then it gradually decreases throughout the day, reaching its lowest levels in the evening, which is when we then start to produce melatonin instead, which is our sleep hormone. So what we should see is cortisol peaking first thing in the morning around waking, peaking again, known as the cortisol awakening response, within about an hour of waking, or 40 minutes. That helps us feel alert and energized in the morning. So if you're somebody, for example, who wakes up in the morning and it takes you ages to even speak, to even know where you are, like if you're just someone who's like, do not talk to me for at least an hour or two, and you just feel quite fatigued for a long time, then potentially you're not having this cortisol peak in the morning, which is what we do need for a healthy circadian rhythm. Then around midday, levels begin to, they peak slightly again around midday, but then they begin to just decline. And then there's a further dip mid-afternoon, and then they get at their absolute lowest in the evening before bed, helping us wind down and sleep. And as I said, we make melatonin in its place. So if cortisol levels are chronically low, that 4-point saliva test will show us low levels of cortisol pretty much all day at every point. And then you're like, right, okay, you have low levels of cortisol all the time. Vice versa, if they're always high, but we're always likely see a dysregulated pattern if we have high levels of cortisol specifically. So for example, it's usually high at night, low in the morning. So high at night, leaving us tired but wired. Low in the morning, leaving us fatigued in the morning. So just because we're fatigued in the morning, it doesn't necessarily mean we have overall low levels of cortisol. It can just mean that we've got a dysregulated pattern. Overall, our levels are high. So this is why this, for example, using certain supplements that bring it up or bring it down, not ideal unless we do the test. So if you, without testing, just go with a good quality blend of adaptogenic herbs that don't contain licorice, that don't contain relora, and don't contain phosphatidylserine. So hopefully that's helpful. I hope you've learned something new in this episode. And most importantly, I really hope that you've picked up some tips that you can actually start to implement practically and feel better. So do feedback, drop me an email or an Instagram message, any questions that you've got, any ideas for topics for the future, because I'm looking for feedback from you as opposed to just me sitting there thinking about what to talk about, which I can do, of course, and I will do. But I like to know that my community are getting the information that they're asking for. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you in the next episode. Bye-bye.
If you enjoyed this episode and you're wanting a bit more support, there's a few ways I can help you. You can take my free perimenopause quiz, join my Midlife Thrive membership, or work with me one-to-one. And I'll leave all the details in the show notes. And if this episode resonated, I'd love you to share it with someone who might need to hear it too. Thank you so much for being here. It really means a lot. And I'll see you in the next episode.